Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 77, section 2. We got into the section a little ways. I'll tell you the paragraph in a second. For the old single column, page 857, it's the seventh paragraph. After that big paragraph break, right after it says Avalon Surgeons there at the end of the preceding paragraph. So recall, speaking of the Avalon Surgeons, just recall that last little bit that they were giving us here about the Noddites. You know, that you know, 500,000 years ago, you started with the prince's staff, who were biologically Andonite. But after 300,000 years of being exposed to, you know, this very significant energy input from them, you know, being related to the, you know, you being able to use the Tree of Life and being plugged into those energy circuits, as they were talking about right there, and you know, the last thing we were looking at last time, those energies are mutagenic. So their genetics had modified significantly from that evolutionary stock, that pre-blended race, as it were, you know, that pre-colored race of the Andonites into a variation of that that was a lot like Adamic genetics. But with that interesting twist of an Adamic genetics that has this innately centered, balanced evolutionary foundation. You know, it's not one of the six biased expressions of one of the six Sangiks, one of the six colored races. And it's this, so that was a significant part of the experiment on this world by the life carriers to have that kind of genetics being part of the eventual blend, you know, to kind of, you know, yes, it's a very lowly, genetics, because it's, you know, you're very minimally human, as an Andonite, but like I just said, unlike the six colored races, you know, it's symmetric, right? It isn't oblong in one direction or another. And so it has that interesting potential to it. If you just lift it up, you don't have to sort of get it centered first and then lift it up. You know, it's already centered. And so you end up, you know, even though in many ways the Noddites are a lot like the Violet Race, a lot like the Adamites, you know, and blend together with the Adamites in a very kind of immediate way. It's, you know, they definitely need to be differentiated as a separate race to begin with, because they have that different foundation that no material son and daughter have coming down from Gerasim. And so we... They, you know, they were giving us that little bit about the mutagenic aspect of those you know, as they call them, the life maintenance circuits of the Satania system. There, they were just immediately focusing on the primary 100 of the prince's staff, and of course, the rebel subset. Of course, that actually biologically procreated to produce the Noddite race. But there's that secondary hundred, you know, set of the prince's staff. The original Andonites, from which they got the genetics to build the bodies for the primary 100, you know, and that donor 100 were also modified. You know, we're using the tree of life, and so the rebel bunch of them also, you know, then were procreating and producing another flavor of Noddite, if you will, you know, which then, of course, you know, in a relatively short span of time, blended together into a homogenized Noddite race. Yep.
Did the analog 100 of the modifieds, did they all follow their kind of doubles into the rebellion? Or?
Well, we're gonna talk about that here in just a second. You know, I mean, I was just... Yeah, kind of teeing that up. You know, that's where we stopped. We were just about to read about, you know, they're going to give us a little bit about, you know, that's what the big paragraph break is about, you know, doing a little aside about the, you know, the secondary 100, if you will, you know, of the prince's staff and how they feed into the mix. So let's just, let's get into what they say, and then we'll talk a little bit about, you know, some of those detail issues that we can speculate about a little bit. Okay, so what do we have here?
It will be recalled that the 100 Andonite germplasm contributors were in turn made possessors of the organic complement of the Tree of Life, so that the Satania life currents likewise invested their bodies. The 44 modified Andonites who followed the staff into rebellion also made it among themselves and made a great contribution to the better strains of the Noddite people.
Okay, so so to immediately to your question, Chris, you know, we're reminded again, yeah, it's an even number. Right, we have these two groups of rebel staff members. You know, each group is an even number, and you can see how they made a point of saying they aren't just mating willy-nilly. You know, these modified Andonites are mating amongst themselves initially. You know, and the same way with the primary ones, they were obviously mating amongst themselves. And so it's very suspicious that no pairs were broken up, you know, in the rebellion. You can't say, you know, with absolute certainty, but highly suspicious, you know, that, well, we've got even numbers here. So that they probably joined the rebellion or not in the pairs, these complementary pairs. So, you know, even though they weren't procreating for 300,000 years, you know, staff members, they were still working together in these pairs because male and female is complementary, right? And, you know, so they were, you know, and they're serving as examples of that, you know, kind of monogamous, even though they are, you know, literally mating, that monogamous sort of pairing. They're serving as examples for all the evolutionary mortals. Obviously, we're, you know, that far back, we're, you know, we're in very primitive states of development of marriage institutions and stuff like that. So you know, it certainly appears that you've got sort of the long-standing pairs now actually going forward and mating. You know, Nod would have, you know, as the leader, would have said, you know, go for it, everyone. Because even though they were going to be alive for quite a while, everyone knew they were mortal now. And, you know, if their movement was not going to die off in short order, they needed to procreate. Okay, and... we've got, you know, you just have that basic issue. You know, I already teed up all the other stuff before we started reading. So, you know, what happens then after that? You know, let's get a little bit more here.
These two groups embracing 104 individuals who carried the modified Andonite germplasm constitute the ancestry of the Noddites, the eighth race to appear on Urantia. And this new feature of human life on Urantia represents another phase of the outworking of the original plan of utilizing this planet as a life modification world, except that this was one of the unforeseen developments.
Right, so unforeseen development, but like I was saying up front, the first big thing was that the six Sangic races aren't races 1 through 6, they're races 2 through 7. That you had race number 1 before them, and then you're just producing this modified expression of that atypical race in the Noddites, sort of upstepped Andonites. So like they're saying, you didn't get that additional race, the Andonites, playing into the mix the way the life carriers had planned, but you definitely got them playing into the mix. You're going to have a flavor of people on this planet that can be upsteppers that you definitely don't have on a normal world. I mean, those Noddites can go out and mate now with the evolutionary peoples, and function as biologic uplifters, but of a different flavor than normal. And of course, that's what they do. And eventually the Adamites and the Noddites blend together, and then you have that blended stock as ongoing biologic uplifters. All right, let's see, what else do we have there? Maybe just one little thing. We've talked about this a few times, when they say at the end, except that this was one of the unforeseen developments. The specific issue, yes, is unforeseen. But you know how brilliant the life carriers are. That when they design life for a world, they would do so with all kinds of what-ifs in mind. Right? They would have run all sorts of simulations and scenarios like, well, what if this were to happen, or what if this? And what if some catastrophe befalls this one Sangic race and you don't have that? What will the resultant blend be like? And they would have gone through all sorts of different scenarios. So even though something very unexpected came to pass on this world in a specific sense, the life carriers, none of them would be going, oh my goodness, we didn't think of that possibility. That puts it outside of the proper margins, and now everything is going to fall apart. Right? No matter what kind of stresses are put on the system, they've got that built in so that everything can still go forward nonetheless. They would have, and we can all appreciate just how much planning went into our design, how resilient we are, how many things can befall us, and we're still alive. We're very robust. The life carriers, build in huge design margins, so that you can handle lots and lots of stresses and not have humans die out. And that's an important thing to stress, because there's so many voices in the world today that preach to you without that understanding. Right? They preach to you, as chicken littles, with the initial assumption that humans are a very fragile thing that just, magically, in a very low probability, bubbled up out of the mud, right? And they're this tenuous, delicate thing that, You know, if anything blinks wrong, the human race is just going to die off. Right? I mean, you know, people who are trying to, be recognized as some authority figure or make a lot of money or whatever, I mean, they love to play that sort of a message to you. Right? You know, you should be very afraid, you know, of that such and so could happen and everyone's going to die off. No. Life is very, very robust. All you need is one to consider one plant that everyone has experienced as a little reminder of how unstoppable life is. It's this little yellow flower called a dandelion, right? Right. If you think that humans are going to do something, right, and all life is going to die out, seriously, right? I mean because again, everyone is judging it like, well, the dandelion is just that little thing in front of me. No, that's a little manifestation of a being the size of Nebadon, right? The creative mother spirit is the power behind all life. And, you can pick the dandelion, but you've done nothing to the creative mother spirit. She just comes right back. As we read through the whole evolution of life, there's this very encouraging species that develops, but a catastrophe befalls it and it disappears. Do the life carriers go, well, that's it? No. I mean, 100 million years later, right, the basic essence of that species comes into existence again, right? Because there's a purpose behind it all. It's not just a blob of matter. There's mind and spirit and personality. There's purpose behind it all. And, and so just keep that in mind when someone is trying to get you to, join their cause and contribute money, and they tell you, if we don't do this, 3 billion people are going to die. It's like, as if humans were that fragile. I mean, that's humanism, right? When people think like that, that's the essence of humanism, right? That's a failure to recognize God is behind it all. And not just that existential father. There's the God of immanence, right? God the Mother, that's right here with this phenomenon in time and is powering it temporally in the moment. Not just existentially in eternity. So, that's good news that a lot of people don't want to become common knowledge, right? Their whole business model breaks down, right? They're auditioning for the modern shaman position. They want to be that person that is the exception to all the rules and can stand there and tell you all the rules that you need to follow, but they don't have to follow any of those rules. That's the shaman position, right? And they get you to allow them to be in that position through fear, right? And the current mode of fear is really predicated on humanism and materialism, philosophic materialism. The life carriers designed us in very robust fashion, and they have to do that because it's not the actuality that's the fundamental issue about the relationship to eternity, this world having a future, right? It's the potentiality, right? And the life has a potential to deal with a vast range of what-ifs, of vicissitudes. Especially when you think of it in collective. I mean, obviously any given organism has its limits. But the total life on the planet, right, is is insuperable. Right? Nothing is going to overwhelm it. So that's a little aside. So, you know, just reminding you that when you're talking about the Noddites, you start with two slightly different flavors. In that particular, when we read that section back, that third paragraph there, in that instance, they were pointing out that example of sort of higher type mortals mating with lesser ones, the higher ones there in that particular Genesis passage can be understood as the Noddites, you know, those Nephilim. But you'll see here in a little bit, I mean, you have a number of different cases where you've got, this quality difference, in the genetics, and they're coming together, the sons of God and the daughters of men. You know, there's several different pairings, but that classic one in Genesis there, replace the word Nephilim by Noddite and understand what's going on there. Yeah. Okay, let's keep going here.
The pure line Noddites were a magnificent race, but they gradually mingled with the evolutionary peoples of Earth, and before long, great deterioration had occurred. 10,000 years after the rebellion, they had lost ground to the point where their average length of life was little more than that of the evolutionary races.
Okay, so they're just pointing. See, they're a magnificent race, so they're definitely biologic uplifters, effectively, even though that wasn't the plan. But it doesn't take long because it's a small drop of higher quality in a big ocean. So 10,000 years and it's pretty much diffused, right? And a little drop of chocolate is blended into the milk and you can barely tell that the milk isn't pure white anymore. You go from, what would be hundreds of years of lifespan down to, basically what it still is today. Now, not life expectancy, remember, that's a separate issue, the vicissitudes of life, but, actual longevity. What's the potential length of the lifespan? If the tree doesn't fall on you or someone's spear doesn't pierce you, right? notice that they're just focusing on the Noddites, relative to the Noddites, as they're mating with the evolutionary stock, that group of people are deteriorating. But of course, the people that they're mating with, they're being uplifted, right? And as they point out, a little goes a long way, right? If we didn't have these few drops of higher quality genetics, this planet would be, there wouldn't be any civilization on the planet, for instance. And right? I mean, you would be trying to convince yourself there was something significant about just the slightest little bit of more fancy culture, right? And trying to say, well, there's civilization there, But definitive civilization just can't happen without biologic uplift. That's why biologic uplifters come to a world. And you certainly wouldn't have any tendency for things to change over a time scale shorter than like 100,000 years. Right? Boulder looks a lot different than it did when I was born here. Right? If there was nothing but Sangic blood, that wouldn't be the case. You could come back to this location 100,000 years later and it would look exactly the same. Right? The little huts or whatever that everyone was living in would be built exactly the same as they've been for the last 100,000 years. And right, things change very slowly without that directionality that Adamic-like biology brings into the system. You know, and otherwise, it's a place-like thing that just stays the same. There wouldn't be any political campaigns where, you know, the key word in the campaign is the word change. If it wasn't for the Noddites and the Adamites. You know, no one would be thinking in terms of that sort of going along a line and changing things. You know, the only way humans change without that is in spite of themselves. They get changed. They don't initiate change. All right. Okay, but in this case, you know, relative to the last 200,000 years, right, just 10,000 years, pretty small, you know, small fraction of that, you basically don't have a definitive Noddite race anymore. Right? You still have, you know, those that haven't totally moved, you know, if they're still kind of localized, okay, there'll be at least a pool of culture there that's different from other places. But genetically, it's pretty much just like everyone else's genetics after just 10,000 years. All right, so now we're going to get, you know, speaking of one of those little pools that doesn't, you know, that geographically didn't diffuse, down there in the southern part of Mesopotamia, you know, until recorded history, you kept one of those little cultural pools. Right, the Sumerians. So they're going to bring up a couple little details here.
When archaeologists dig up the clay tablet records of the later day Sumerian descendants of the Noddites, they discover lists of Sumerian kings running back for several thousand years. And as these records go further back, the reigns of the individual kings lengthen from around 25 or 30 years up to 150 years and more. This lengthening of the reigns of these older kings signifies that some of the early Noddite rulers, immediate descendants of the prince's staff, did live longer than their later-day successors, and also indicates an effort to stretch the dynasties back to Dalmatia.
Okay, so, and there's another issue they'll bring up in the next paragraph, but so there's two things. When you look at one of those Sumerian kings lists, you definitely see this. You get this long, long list of kings, and you know, as you go back, you know they're living, you know, huge lengths of time, supposedly. You know, some of that, like they're pointing out, has to do with a literal fact. I mean, the numbers might not be what, you know, the actual reign lengths, but you know, as you can see from the way they're saying it, but just the fact that they are longer, there's a truth to that. Because, you know, like, remember, Adam lived to be 530. So, right, so, Nod and, you know, they would have lived hundreds of years. We don't know how long, but eventually, you know, it gets down to where, you know, a king that isn't being overthrown, you know, he's not going to be king for much more than 25, 30 years, right? I mean, just... we all die. you know. So, you know, there's not many that are like Queen Elizabeth II, right? You know, or Queen Victoria or someone like that, you know, that has these very long reigns. That's a very exceptional thing. And then the other thing is, so, you know, you can imagine how nostalgic these Noddites were about the good old days. And so you can go forward, you know, many, many millennia, and they would still be trying to hold on to Dalmatia in the glory days of old, you know, in their mythologies and whatnot. And, you know, so even when you go all the way up to recorded history with the Sumerians, you know, they would be trying to hearken back. And so you're making these lists, and, you know, and the oldest ones are going to have extremely ridiculous long reign times because they're trying to extend it way, way back. Now, you know, you think, well, man, they've got to go back 500,000 years. Well, no, remember there's a thing that comes into play. I mean, by the time you get to the Sumerians, you know, let's say in 5,000 BC or 4,000 BC or something, it's gotten all blurred in everyone's minds. No one is actually separating Adam and Eve from Dalmatia, you know, from the second garden, you know, specifically, from Dalmatia. It's all blurred together because second garden's in Mesopotamia. So just geographically, see, it's got a tendency to blur together. You know, and so actually what they are doing with those king lists is they're trying to get enough numbers to add up to getting you back to when Adam and Eve arrived. And you can look at those lists and you can see they did a great job of that, of remembering how long ago accurately Adam and Eve arrived. You know, and they're trying to get a number of, you know, of rains that add up to getting you back to 35,915 BC.
That's in the Bible?
No, not you know, in the Bible. What are they trying to do? You know, they're doing a similar thing in the Bible. What are they doing in the Bible? They're trying to get you from Adam and Eve to Noah initially, right? You know, eventually to Abraham. You know, and there, you know, you're doing that by having people like Methuselah and whatnot. You know, we're going to mention that in a little bit here. But there's another element in play there that they're about to mention, but. In terms of how old those people were. But setting aside the specific ages of those people, you know, that the Bible gives, you have a similar idea. You have a seminal beginning point and then a, you know, sort of direct historical point, and you're trying to connect the two dots by getting leaders or kings or whatever, you know, back dot to dot, back to the beginning. And you know, and again, you know, obviously in the Bible they're going back to Adam and Eve. And so, I mean, that was universal. I mean, eventually everything pre-Adam and Eve, you know, is lost in the mists of the past. And though the curtain of memory of the ancient past, you know, is really at the time of Adam and Eve. Everything else is kind of just brought up to that time. You know, the million years before that, the rationalization schemes are just trying to get back. But see, unlike the Bible, the Sumerian kings list, you know, those Noddites, you know, descendants, the Sumerians, they actually knew literally how long ago Adam and Eve were here. You know, the Bible authors don't have anything literal. Those guys actually, you know, were counting, right? They were counting weeks. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and making tick marks, you know. They were remembering how long it was. They had a record. And so when you take into account what they're about to tell you in the next paragraph, you know, you can see that they were very serious about that memory. They were keeping track very well. Okay, so let's read a little bit more here.
The records of such long-lived individuals are also due to the confusion of months and years as time periods. This may also be observed in the biblical genealogy of Abraham and in the early records of the Chinese. The confusion of the 28-day month or season with the later introduced year of more than 350 days is responsible for the traditions of such long human lives. There are records of a man who lived over 900 quote-unquote years. This period represents not quite 70 years, and such lives were regarded for ages as very long, 70 years and 10. As such, a lifespan was later designated.
Right. So as you have, you know, as we often point out, as you have in the 90th Psalm, 70 years and 10, or by reason of strength, 80. Right. That longevity is still what we have today. And it goes all the way back. Remember when we first read about the Andonites, it was Andon and Fonta. What was the longevity of those original Andonites? Does anyone remember?
Same, isn't it?
75 years. Right? So, the longevity on this planet started at 75. And the only thing that's changed is you've got some back mating, right, that diminishes it to 70, and some biologic uplift that increases it to 80. And there we are still. Sure, you know, it's a bell curve, so there's tails, right? You know, we all know that there's some peoples with more, Andite blood that have, you know, a little bit longer longevities. What's in the Old Testament, the Old Testament there is basically it, right? I mean, we've just got a little bit of a spread around that initial 75. And, you know, when they're saying there are records of a man who lived over 900 years, right? I mean, when you go through that list in Genesis, it's trying to get you from Adam to Noah initially. Right, you've got, say, like Methuselah living 969 years. So it says, as they're pointing out, no, that's a misunderstanding. That's 969 28-day months. All right, so you just do the math. Multiply 969 by 28 and divide it by 365.2425 and see how many years it is, right? And you'll see it's 74 years.
You did that already, I guess.
Right. Now, all right, and they just did one for you. If you take 70, right, you'll get 69 years. You know, actual years. I said 700. 900. If you take the 900, sorry. If you take the 900, like they say there, right, and convert that to actual years, that's 900 28-day months. Right, that's actually 69 years. So, you've got them maxing out. See, even Methuselah, the longest one in that list, and it's only 969. Right, so he's not even getting to, by reason of strength, fourscore. And that's only 74 years. You got just a 5-year range, right? You're basically from 69 to 74. That's just, that helps you to appreciate that you didn't have sort of the cream of the genetics there. And someone is remembering how long they lived. It's just that we got confused. We don't recognize anymore that they weren't counting, trips around the sun. They were counting 7-4 times. Yeah. And that quasi sort of month, 28 days.
Synchronized to the moon, anyway. Mm-hmm.
And so it's the same way in the Sumerian kings list, right, as they're pointing out. You've got the two things they said before. One, they're trying to stretch it all the way back to Dalmatia. Two, some of them lived a lot longer, so they reigned a lot longer. But also you go back far enough and you're not, it says it's years, but it isn't actually. It's some number of 28-day months. And then if you go back far enough, it's neither. It's just a made-up number. It's trying to get them, way, way, way back. Okay? But the interesting thing is, even though when you look at all the specific numbers, and they have all of this sort of arbitrariness to them, when all is said and done, the total span of time that they say elapsed, that those Sumerians were saying lapsed from when the gods came down to earth, i.e. when Adam and Eve arrived, right? until, quote-unquote, the flood, and you've got to figure out know, what sort of big deluge event or whatever they were thinking, you know, was the flood, you know. It's not the mythological biblical flood thing, but, you know, you have, everyone has these flood stories. You know, you figure out, well, probably the Sumerian flood was, you know, somewhere back there in the, you know, in the early part of the third millennium BC. You know, and you just take how long they say it is from Adam and Eve until that point. Sure enough, you know, you do the convert it from 28-day months to years, and ta-da, you're back where the Urantia book says Adam and Eve came, 35,915 BC. Almost spot on. See, they were seriously counting, keeping track. You know, they were remembering how far back it was that Adam showed up. You know, and they may have said that was, you know, in their writings, they may say that was Dalmatia, you know, and whatnot. But see, it's actually Adam. And you can, and so that's why they give you that precise number, you know, for when Adam and Eve arrived. You know, it's kind of startling. Remember, we noticed that. It's like, wow, they give it right to the year, you know, when they arrived. It's so you have that data point, and you can recognize what I was just saying. What it is that the Sumerians are remembering back to, and then how serious they were about remembering that. And, you know, they almost remember it exactly. And that's a long time to be counting, thousands and thousands of years to be going 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, tick, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, tick. Yeah, because we've been counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 like that. We've had that 7-day week, you know, all the way back 500,000 years ago. And that's never broken. You know, we've all kinds of changes in the calendar and, you know, what we think are months and years and all this sort of stuff has changed all over the place. But we've been counting over and over to 7 for 500,000 years religiously. Okay?
Never want to forget which day. So,
you know, when they, 500,000 years ago, when the prince's staff told everyone, "Now you need to take what we're saying very seriously." Boy, they, you know, we did. You know, yes, sir. We've been counting to 7 religiously ever since. All right. Let's see, anything else there? I guess not. Just, you know, you notice they, you got the same thing. You know, get another people that have a recorded history that goes back a long ways, like the Chinese, and, you know, and you run into the exact same thing. You know, we don't have a lot of peoples that remember very far back. You know, like, say, the Northern Europeans, you know, you know, there isn't much for recorded history. Plus, you know, they were all burning their dead, you know, so we don't even have, you know, bodies or anything we can dig up. And, you know, and a lot of those areas were scraped by glaciers. And, yeah, I mean, we don't have a lot of peoples that have any sort of a recorded history that harkens back very, very far. But you take the sons of Han, you know, have been there in China for a long time, and, you know, or the Sumerians sitting there and right where they were 500,000 years ago in southern Mesopotamia. You know, and those people have some long, long memories. Okay, so when did this really go from a 28-day, quote-unquote, year, right, to the 365 thing? And that's what they give you a little footnote paragraph here.
The reckoning of time by the 28-day month persisted long after the days of Adam. But when the Egyptians undertook to reform the calendar about 7,000 years ago, they did it with great accuracy, introducing the year of 365 days.
Yeah. So once they finally got to that point, having the astronomical understanding, you know, they figured it out quite accurately. Okay, now you have a precision issue to begin with. I mean, it's accurately 365 days, you know, but, you know, that's just three significant digits. When you get to Julius Caesar, right, you get 365.25, right? Because every fourth year is a leap year, right? And so we had the Julian calendar for a long time. More precise, but after many centuries, things were way off whack. Right? The vernal equinox wasn't anywhere near where the calendar said it was. So you had the Gregorian calendar reform. You know, Pope Gregory the 13th in the 16th century reformed the calendar to what we use now. We added a couple more decimal places of precision to the number. Right? So the year is 365.2425. Right? And that's just, you get that by, you know, not having a leap year sometimes. And we all know that a little more complicated rules for leap years in the Gregorian calendar. But obviously both of those round to 365, right? So, okay, I mean, 365 is accurate, it's just not highly precise. So on the one hand, you've got, wow, 5,000 BC, right? They had that pretty solid, you know, which is basically back there at the beginning of recorded history, you know, that sort of sixth millennium BC, from 6,000 to 5,000 BC, is sort of the beginning of recorded history. So there's that, which is, you know, impressive in and of itself. But like they're saying, I mean, the 28-day month persisted long after the days of Adam. Right, so if you have memories of those people going forward from Adam, right, they're being remembered in some number of 28-day months. So obviously, when you go to the Bible and it says 900 and whatever, right, those aren't 365-day years. Those are 28-day months. And you quickly see that when you just do the, you know, the calculation. Ta-da, you're somewhere between 70 and 80. Right?
It seems like yep. For people, somehow it was carrying through. And
yeah.
I look today and I go, wow, you know, we're not even thinking about having fathers.
Yeah, I mean, how many people today don't even know, who the last four presidents were, or something, right? Or we all know basic civic things like that. Or most people are oblivious. The people were serious back then, right? I mean, they were remembering this stuff, you know, not just a handful of historians, but everyone knew these stories, and everyone took this stuff seriously, and. You know, we used to take our founding fathers seriously until, right, there was an active effort to purge them from our memories,
yeah.
Right? So that we'd be severed from our foundations of integrity and could be led off into the wilderness, right, intellectually, philosophically. So on the one hand, it's kind of almost an OCD sort of thing that these people were doing way back when, but there's an important element there. You need to hold on to your foundations. You can't start expect to be a stable civilization when you're floating up in some airy fairy space with no solid foundation underneath you. So it's a good little that's a good point. A little reminder of that. How few people take this stuff seriously anymore. They can't even tell you, who the current president is, at any time, now or the previous president or the president before that, you ask the man, everyone knows the man on the street thing, yeah. Clinton's president, you go out in the street, who's president right now? I don't know. Obviously, they don't know anything. When was the Revolutionary War? Wasn't that like 1960? We all know how hopeless it is, when you ask these people these sorts of questions. So, Like, you know, but no, like these people, they actually remember 35,915 BC. They've been counting it very precisely that whole time. Yeah. Okay, so now, you know, like we've been pointing out, you can't help but be touching on little sort of highlights in the Genesis story, you know, what things are actually tied to actual history, you know, in there. And the one that you might think is some just total fabrication, the Tower of Babel, no. Actually, right, the story in the Bible is mostly fanciful, you know, in its details, but there actually was, very long ago, a tower. And the answer of like, well, who was up to it? Was it those people immediately following the flood and Noah? No. It was the Noahites. Right, that's who actually was involved in that story that's gotten remembered and reworked. It's in the Bible. So let's read about that. How long ago was it, and what was the actual scoop?
Section 3, the Tower of Babel. After the submergence of Dalmatia, the Noahites moved north and east, presently founding the new city of Dilmun as their racial and cultural headquarters. And about 50,000 years after the death of Nod, when the offspring of the prince's staff had become too numerous to find subsistence in the lands immediately surrounding their new city of Dilmun, and after they had reached out to intermarry with the Andonite and Sangic tribes adjoining their borders, it occurred to their leaders that something should be done to preserve their racial unity. Accordingly, a council of the tribes was called, and after much deliberation, the plan of Bablot, a descendant of Nod, was endorsed.
Okay, a number of little tidbits there. One, you've got that, you know, you've got this name that we know about, Dilmun. So, and they're explaining, see how that actually came to be. You don't have some original name. And remember, the name Dalmatia, okay, that's been coined for the Urantia book. And that isn't what they actually, you know, they didn't, you know, use Latin and Greek and whatnot, right, back 500,000 years ago, right? I mean, that's that, you know, that name has been coined for us just for the sake of the revelation. But, you know, you subsequent to that city way down there in the southern part of the Mesopotamia going underwater and them having to move north, right, you had this city of Dilmun. And as I point out, that gets, it's actually that name, not Dalmatia, quote unquote, that gets blurred in with the second garden and whatnot. Okay. You know, remember what's going on here. I mean, you had that temporary situation, you know, if you remember way back to the rebellion, story about the rebellion, where the master physical controllers lifted the ocean locally there for a little while and washed away the father's temple because it was being abused, right? But then they let it back down again. Yeah. That's not this, you know, when they talk about after the submergence of Dalmatia, not that temporary issue. But remember, you've got vast changes in the ocean level due to the Ice Age, you know, ebbing and, you know, and flowing, literally, right? You know, like, for instance, you know, everyone loves to worry and talk about the, you know, sea level rise, right, these days. You know, let's put that in some historical context. Right, you know, like the Revelators point out, about 35,000 years ago was really kind of the end of the Ice Age. You know, and the only ice that remains is in the polar regions. Eventually that will disappear too, and the Ice Age is totally done. But, you know, you went from that little bit of ice on the poles that we have now to the vast sheets of ice before that. There's a lot of ice, you know, like in North America, Right? You've got a vast sheet of ice covering, you know, most of Canada, you know, going all the way down into the United States. I mean, we're at the southern border in the United States. I mean, the ice is a mile thick, right? Right. So, you know, a mile thick or deeper, you know, covering that whole northern space, that's a lot of ice. So obviously when that melted, the sea went up a lot. And I mean, the, you know, since that ice started melting, I mean, the sea has gone up like 400 feet. Right, you know, and so when people tell you, you know, I mean, if the sea level rises an inch, we're all going to die. I mean, what are we talking about? Right, I mean, it's gone up 400 feet, right, in the last, you know, few thousand years. Right, I mean, things change radically, you know, and. So, you know, you need to keep this stuff in perspective. Temperatures have changed a lot. Sea level has changed a lot. You know, what's desert and what's temperate has changed a lot. And all these things are seldom given a decent historical context. You know, so when they're sitting there trying to figure, I think it's gone up 3 millimeters. It's like, okay, relative to 400 feet, that's not a very significant change. You know, let's put it in some context here.
Chris, yep. What about the timing, 3,000 years compared to how long it takes for what's happening now?
Again, we have...
Doesn't that matter, though?
The more andite blood we have, the more the universe will encourage us to use our adaptability. You know, I mean, see, I mean, again, it works both ways. You know, we have to decide, do we want change or not? Right? Lots of people are always clamoring for change, but apparently not all changes, just some changes. right. You know, and see, of course, when all is said and done, it doesn't matter whether humans want change or not. Everything will change. You know, the world, when this world is settled in light and life, you know, if you're brought back here, you won't even recognize the geography. It'll be completely different, right? You know, the little beach bungalow on the sandbar called Florida won't be there anymore, you know, and stuff like that, right?
I'm just saying it's a little fast and dramatic because it's so fast.
Yeah, but...
Which, there's nothing we can do
about it. I mean, again...
But it's different than saying 3,000 years.
Yeah, just remember, you know, we have this tendency. It's like, well, it's fast, therefore it's bad, or it's unpleasant to me, therefore it's bad. Or
well, change without growth.
Who's to say? Who's to say it's not? You know, it's good or bad.
Just an example: the volcano in Guatemala. It's pretty dramatic and pretty fast, and a lot of people have died. But how long will it be when things settle down and people are building their homes back up there on the mountainside? It
won't be very long at all.
Won't be long at all.
No. All right. You know.
Pretty calm up there. Let's get
you know, I mean, you know, the area around Mount St. Helens is going to be really beautiful, you know, homeland here, you know, in short order. And there'll be all kinds of people wanting to build there. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's just we it's not that... Again, it's not a dichotomy. It's not saying that because things change, you don't have to be concerned about changes. It's just, all I'm pointing out is, notice how people don't put things in a context. Right? They isolate their facts. Right? You know, they talk about change in carbon dioxide. I mean, carbon dioxide has changed radically over, you know, like we were reading, you know, back when we were going through the biologic evolution papers. I mean, why was there a carboniferous? Right? It's because there was so much more carbon dioxide in the air. I mean, vastly more than we can even imagine humans putting in the air. Was everything dead? No, it was one of the most dynamic living periods of the world's history. But... I mean, again, it's not that we shouldn't be concerned about the environment. It's just that we need to be objective about this. Right? If we base things on our ignorance and our subjectivity, what's happened in the last 5 years, the glaciers haven't changed that much in the last 5 years, so therefore it's a cataclysm? I mean, the glaciers have changed a lot over the last 2 million years as the ice ages have and flowed. Right? I mean, these things change. We have to keep that in mind. And you know, and as I pointed out, you know, this whole why is the beginning of recorded history about 6,000 to 5,000 BC? Because that's when the climate settled down. Before that, climate was extremely variable. You know, and about every 1,000 years, everyone had to totally move. Places that were inhabitable became uninhabitable, and vice versa. And you lost, everyone lost track of history. Right, but coincidentally, we know there's not a coincidence. It settled down. The climate settled down. You know, so that by 5,000 BC, you know, and since then, for the last 7,000 years, we've had this relatively stable climate, allowing us to get settled and get civilization going a little bit. And now that we have the scientific means to deal with more variability, don't be surprised if the Earth starts changing again. Right? Right? It's just the way it is. Yeah.
Something that I like to think of about all the change, and I keep thinking about this infinite love of God, and infinitely love everybody right where they're at, right where they're at.
Yeah. Yeah, and just, you know, yeah, and I mean, see, that's a great way, you know, I mean, again, the more change there is in the external world, the more it, you know, and the more that doesn't sort of give you peace, the peace that you desire deep inside, it should remind you that, there's an inner life that's not really ever been discovered, like we often talk about on this world, right? God loves your inner life, you. He has no relationship to the outer life, you. You know, and if you want to love someone else, not have affection for someone else, that's an outer life to outer life thing. If you want to actually love someone else, it has to be from your inner life to their inner life, right? You love the real person that's in their inner life, not the apparent person, their outer life.
But they may never be the inner life. You know, some people are so evil that it'll never happen.
But still, you know, as long as they're a human, God loves them. So potentially, I could too. Right? I may never see any sign of their inner life coming forth. They're so focused in a selfish way on their outer life and the pleasures that they can find there, you know, at everyone else's expense. That doesn't mean they don't have an inner life, right? Especially post-Pentecost, right? We all are encircled and, you know, in the Holy Spirit and have thought adjusters by grace. It's just important to remember that we get so fixated on these outer life issues, whether it's I'm having a really hard time, I'm not getting very angry at that person, or I don't like the way my favorite place in northern Africa is becoming the Sahara Desert now, right? Or whatever it might be, all these outer life things, you can deal with them and all the changes and all of the inadequacies, the limitations, you know, that are there. You know, if you seek for something deeper and higher, right, and just don't be satisfied with a lowly definition of the word love, for instance, like you're bringing up. Back to 150,000 years ago, you see, is when they got this idea that they should do something to indicate the nature of themselves as a people. And you notice the author here, the word that was selected, their racial unity. Did you see that? The word unity. You're going, well, wait a minute, that's a spirit word. What, you know, what does that have to do with? No, that's the whole point, see? Right? It's that purity, unity thing, right? They've got a false application of their spiritual consciousness being applied to material issues. Right? See, so it's very purposeful on the author's part to use that the same way we do it. When we start to get prideful, we start to apply that's what should be directed towards eternity. When we direct it to material and temporal affairs, right, and start inappropriately using spirit words for material issues, like race. So obviously there's an ism, see, in play here. This is going to produce a problem. Yeah. So that's the backstory of the mess that ensues with the Tower of Babel, is that inappropriate application of spiritual idealism to material affairs. It's material idealism. And a lot of it is kind of a chosen people, sort of a thing. You know, those particular molecules, you're very interested in the arrangement of those molecules, and an idealistic arrangement of body molecules. And they want to arrange other molecules, right, to just indicate how grand that arrangement of body molecules is. You know, how can I arrange molecules in the external world to just illustrate how glorious this arrangement of molecules that my body is? And that's what's going on here. So it's that material idealism is going to bring them down here. Let's see, what else do we have in there? It's pretty cool, though, to actually know when that occurred. 150,000 years ago is actually when the tower was. And you can see there, they also mention, see, when they start to intermarry, so you start out with those two flavors of Noddites, and they're going to blend together initially, and then they're going to blend in, both Andonite and Sangic. You've got the full diversity. So it becomes a very, a people with lots of genetic cross currents, which just adds to the potential tensions and imbalances and flying off on a handle and becoming belligerent, and when you don't have a harmonious genetic, internal nature. And then the one other little thing. Scholars have puzzled over Babel, the word Babel, trying to figure out where that comes from. No one knows until now, right? Do you read this? Oh, it's actually going all the way back to someone's name, right? So way back in Noddite speak, whatever they were, there was a guy named Bablet, just like there was a guy named Nod, or Van, and that's not a coined word like Dalmatia, right? I mean, that's an actual name. And, through all the variations, you basically have those same letters, going all the way to Babylon, the word Babylon. It comes from him, his name.
Perhaps an architect.
Yeah. Okay.
Babylon proposed to erect a pretentious temple of racial glorification at the center of their then occupied territory. This temple was to have a tower, the like of which the world had never seen. It was to be a monumental memorial to their passing greatness. There were many who wished to have this monument erected in Dilmun, but others contended that such a great structure should be placed a safe distance from the dangers of the sea, remembering the traditions of the engulfment of their first capital, Dalmatia.
Okay, so yeah, just reminding you again that Dilmun, even though it's further north than the original planetary headquarters was, it's still way down in the southern part of Mesopotamia, you know, quite close to the Persian Gulf. Okay, and so they're going, well, I don't know, should we build it right there? You know, I mean, you know, remember, this is 150,000 years ago, so there's still a lot of glacial, you know, we're deep in the ice age still, so they know there's going to be lots of, you know, melting and, you know, and thawing of ice and whatnot. You know, I remember melting and freezing of ice still to come. All right. You know, and you just got to love it, you know, racial glorification. all right. All like a monumental memorial, all those things. You know, like I said, it's just this. We all know why a lot of people build big things, right?
They mentioned passing greatness.
Yeah. See, and they're, you know, they're obviously, you know, cause like they mentioned, they've intermarried now with the Andonites and the Sangiks. So they all, right, you know, none of them are living hundreds of years anymore, right? You know, they're excited if they make it to 80, just like we are. And, okay. And yeah, so you know, they're trying to hold on by their fingernails, you know, to this passing glory.
Yeah. Over before it starts.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and you can, you know, you know where it's going when they say Babylon proposed to erect a pretentious temple. It's like, oh, this is not going to go well. Yeah. Okay.
Babylon planned that the new buildings should become the nucleus of the future center of the Nadite culture and civilization. His council finally prevailed, and construction was started in accordance with his plans. The new city was to be named Babylon, after the architect and builder of the tower. This location later became known as Babylon and eventually as Babel.
See, so even giving you a little bit of the, you know, the evolution to up to recorded history, you know, and we know how it went, you know, from Babel forward. Yeah, so it just goes back to his name, and you know, you at this point, you just like, well, where exactly, you know, you're going. I mean, his counsel finally prevailed. It's like, well, okay, this is going to Babel. You know, okay, they did move it farther north. They didn't build it all the way down. You know, it's basically right there where the second garden is going to be, like we pointed out. Right? It's in that area, you know, on the Euphrates side, just south of the neck, you know, basically where the second garden ended up. It was in that area because that's where the city-state of Babylon ended up. So they didn't build it down there in the marshy lowlands down by the Persian Gulf.
Was it really cold in the garden?
What was that?
Was it really cold in the garden during the ice age, and what happened?
No. Remember, this is, you know, very far south, so right in latitude, so right, it was very temperate there. Let's see here. You know, the ice, you know, especially in Europe, the ice never went extremely far south in Europe and Asia. You know, there were times when it went further south than other times. You know, remember there was waves. Remember when we were reading through it, you know, it would go deep and then recede, and there would be an interglacial period, and then it would, you know, advance again and recede. And but it never went extremely far south, you know, in Europe and
just like
in Asia.
Just like the North Pole, when they found all
because of, you know, the plants and stuff from warm temperatures and stuff, like the tropics in the North Pole and that.
Yeah. And if you go way back, like we remember we read, before you had a continental climate on the planet, you know, it was a marine climate, and there wasn't any difference between the temperature of the poles and the equator. It was the same temperature over the whole planet, you know, when it was an ocean-dominated climate. You know, you want to talk about climate change, now there's a big one. When it went from marine climate to continental climate, that was, right, there's never going to be climate change bigger than that one. You know, that was a radical change, and, you know, having tropical plants at, you know, in Antarctica, to now.
But, you know, this, if I would have been living back in those days, I would have thought that sounds like a good idea to me to build this, you know.
Yeah, and you can see it wasn't totally just a self-aggrandizement thing. I mean, they know they can't do anything about the fact that the genetic purity is gone. But see, Bablett planned that the new buildings should become the nucleus of the future center of the Nautite culture and civilization. They know that if they reinforce the culture, they can at least keep the culture going. You know, and it, despite the, you know, everything falling apart here, as we're about to read, you do still have the Sumerians at the beginning of recorded history, and they've got all kinds of fancy architecture and, you know, and whatnot. Right, you know, or you can, you know, as we often point out, you can take that little handful of Andites across the Pacific, island hopping across the Pacific, you know, thousands of years ago, and get him to South America, and even though genetically it was insignificant, that little handful, culturally it was huge, right? I mean, and so that, you know, for thousands and thousands of years, you had this very unexplained civilization going on all the way down to, you know, through the Mayans and the Aztecs, right, because of that, right? Instead of just building little thatched huts or something, they're building these big wood stone pyramids and all this stuff. I mean, that, right, the cultural, you know, can be, you can maintain a lot of culture even in a limited genetic people. Okay. And so, you know, they knew that, and so they're like, well, we can at least try to really anchor our civilization and see to it that it endures, even though genetically we've blended in with everyone else now. Okay. Let's see, anything else there? No, let's keep going.
But the Nautites were still somewhat divided in sentiment as to the plans and purposes of their undertaking. Neither were their leaders altogether agreed concerning either construction plans or usage of the buildings after they should be completed. After 4.5 years of work, a great dispute arose about the object and motive for the erection of the tower. The contentions became so bitter that all work stopped. The food carriers spread the news of the dissension, and large numbers of the tribes began to foregather at the building site. Three different views were propounded as to the purpose of building the tower.
Wow, 4.5 years. That's pretty hopeless. So, I mean, relative to that, Adam and Eve lasting 117 years before everything fell apart is a huge success. 4.5 years. I mean, you can imagine how long of a project this would be. This, you know, I mean, you know, and wow, they only make it 4.5 years. So, I think everyone remembers that this, you know, the mythological story in the Bible, you know, of God coming in and confusing their language and all this sort of stuff because they were, you know, they were starting to think they were gods and building a tower to the heavens and all this sort of stuff, right? No, none of that happened. But, you know, this is what really went on. And, you know, there's a reason why the word Babel is often pronounced Babel, right? Because of that story in the Bible, right? That, you know, they all start babbling different languages. Right? But see, you know, it doesn't have two B's. It's obviously not Babel. It's Babel. The word is Babel. But because of that whole Babel language thing in the Bible, that's why it's often pronounced that way. You've got, you'll notice that even though they're genetically blended in and they've got, they're obviously belligerent and stuff like this, you know, there's a basic sort of philosophic argument here, right? You know, just notice that despite all of the issues, they're a relatively high-minded people, right? That they're getting into a, you know, a philosophic argument. Again, the war in heaven, the rebellion that Lucifer started, was a philosophic war, right? Right. It's like, you know, we're using words like purpose here and stuff, see, right? Right. So you know, despite how all the problems with navel gazing and stuff here, you know, it's a people that they're trying to put themselves in a big picture context. They aren't just living for the moment like so many are these days. Right? There's a philosophic quality to what's going on. They have a civilization. Okay. So what is this this philosophic contention that they have here, or dissension? Is there a word they use there? Looks like we've got three camps here. What are the three camps?
One, the largest group, almost one half, desired to see the tower built as a memorial of Nadite history and racial superiority. They thought it ought to be a great and imposing structure, which would challenge the admiration of all future generations.
Okay, so you got that group. That's obviously the, you know, you can, without even reading the other two, it's like, okay, that must be the group that, where there's going to be a lot of this pride, really, you know, dominant, right? The racial superiority and all this sort of stuff, see? So, you know, and the fact that that's the largest group, you know, okay, no wonder this is going to fall apart. It's just, there's, they're getting too self-absorbed here, you know, this effort to be philosophic and to spread out in conformity with the cosmos into righteousness has been flipped around into self-righteousness. Okay, so and that's why I was bringing up that whole bit about the philosophies. You know, they've got this big spherical, you know, holistic thing that they're attempting to do, but you got to make sure the sign is correct, right? That it's oriented outward and not inward. Or this vast thing is self-righteousness rather than righteousness. Okay.
Two, the next largest faction wanted the tower designed to commemorate the Dilmun culture. They foresaw that Babelot would become a great center of commerce, art, and manufacture.
Okay, so, you know, that seems a lot more appropriate to that whole bit about the nucleus of a future center of the Nadite culture and civilization. And trying to, it's like, okay, we've got this culture. Let's really kind of anchor it, solidify it, and see to it that it goes forward. But it's not the largest group, so that's a problem. Okay, what about number three?
Three, the smallest and minority contingent held that the erection of the tower presented an opportunity for making atonement for the folly of their progenitors in participating in the Caligastia rebellion. They maintained that the tower should be devoted to the worship of the Father of all, that the whole purpose of the new city should be to take the place of Dalmatia, to function as the cultural and religious center for the surrounding barbarians.
Oh, they're not going to win. And it's not just a numbers issue.
There's a whole lot of issues.
Yeah, I'm sure that all these Nodites are going to go, yeah, yeah, we should make atonement for... Yeah, you know that's where that's going to go. Now, notice, it's kind of interesting, these three groups. It's not precise, but you actually have a little bit of shades of past, present, future in that order. See that? You got that first group that are really fixated on the past glory. All right. Number two, they're more just, okay, what do we have in front of us right now? All right. And the other ones are really thinking about trying to chart a whole future, you know, and leaving the past behind. So it's very interesting that the three actually is a, you know, is a past, present, future. And it's, see, in that mode, you can think about how I often, you know, point out that the Latins, you know, gave us three different words relative to past, present, future. You have preserve for the past, observe for the present, and conserve for the future. And so that third group, those are the ones that really are future-oriented. They're wanting to conserve, right, what they, the quality they have, and, you know, see to it going forward in the future. Well, if they're like that, that must mean they are basically the have a more definitive religious consciousness. Right? If they are, focused on that conservation mode. Right? They're not the fundamentalist who's looking to the past and trying to preserve it. Right? They're not the orthodox person that's looking to the present and just trying to observe. Right? They're the religionists. That conservation mentality oriented to the future.
Well, I keep getting hung up, though, on their sense that, how do they say it? Oh, they're making atonement for their folly. It's mm-hmm. like, what is there about the religious thing that makes you want to glom onto this guilt complex? And drag that into it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that the little aside there, you know, once we get to the Evolution of Religion papers, right, we bring that all up, and you see it doesn't matter that they're Nodites. They're just like every other mortal that we fundamentally develop our initial religious rationalization schemes based upon that animal origin guilt that we all feel, right? And all of the theological notions revolve around guilt. You know, and how this fundamentally defines our relationship to God, and, you know, and so we need redemption, and, you know, and all these sorts of things. And sin is, you know, is based upon that guilt feeling, and all. You know. So, yeah, that the fact that they use atonement there is just reminding you this is this basic sin sacrifice and atonement mode religiously that they're in. But, you know, the notions aside. Right, it's still just important that superconsciously, right, you've got a religious nature here that is not just bottled up invisibly in the inner life. It's attempting to manifest outward, right, in a future-oriented conservation, you know, conservative mode. You know, and sure enough, you know, look at what they say at the beginning of the next paragraph. Yeah, you got the hint that they said cultural and religious center at the end, but is this actually the religious group? Yes. What does it say?
The religious group were promptly voted down. The majority rejected the teaching that their ancestors had been guilty of rebellion. They resented such a racial stigma. Having disposed of one of the three angles to the dispute, and failing to settle the other two by debate, they fell to fighting. The religionists, the non-combatants, fled to their homes in the South, while their fellows fought until well nigh obliterated.
Those who were last.
Yeah. So the ones with stars upon bars and the ones that, you know, without, you know, got it, yeah. It's just like in the Dr. Seuss story. And they just about, you know, killed each other off. Camps 1 and 2.
Let's take a new vote.
But you see, the group 3, that little core group, you know, they just went back down south. See, so those are the ones that eventually come out, you know, at the beginning of recorded history is the Sumerians. Right, it's group number 3 that projects forward into Samaria. Or as the Sumerians. All right, yeah, just like we suspected, yeah, they were promptly voted down. We knew that wasn't going to go anywhere. You know, and we see the word guilty there, right, just like we were talking about. Let's see, anything else there? Just, you know, notice that they parenthetically throw in the religionists, comma, the non-combatants. So, that's, you know, they've got a high degree of golden ruler thing. And the only reason that they could last for, you know, thousands and thousands of years and come out the other end as the Sumerians is because they're tucked down there at the lower part of Mesopotamia, where basically everyone just left them alone. I mean, even when you had Babylon, right, in there, you still had that residual differential that everyone sort of just, well, you know, they're not, you know, a warlike people, and they're kind of tucked out of the way where they're not in my way, you know, in my you know, conquering mentality, whatever empire I'm trying to build. So they just sort of just, you know, tucked themselves down there and carried on, and it wasn't until very, very recently, you know, that finally those people totally blended. I mean, you know, in Iraq today, you don't have the residual of those people anymore, but until just, you know, definitely way into biblical times, you still had, right, you still had them basically as a little pool down there in southern Mesopotamia, and everyone drew upon them, right, as the Chaldeans, you know, for instance, you know, as the wise people, you know, the whole wise men, right, and all that, right? So they carry forward, you know, pretty much unadulterated after they scurried down there here 150,000 years ago. All right. Then they give you a little footnote here that explains why something that actually happened 150,000 years ago can have such a definitive reference in the Bible. Right, because you think about it, it's like, well, wait a minute. I thought all this stuff prior to Adam and Eve kind of all got lost. 150,000 years ago is long before Adam and Eve. You know, how is it that there's a Tower of Babel story in the Bible? Okay, right. See, so that's what this next little paragraph is about.
About 12,000 years ago, a second attempt to erect the Tower of Babel was made. The mixed races of the Andites, Nodites and Adamites, undertook to raise a new temple on the ruins of the first structure. But there was not sufficient support for the enterprise, and it fell of its own pretentious weight. This region was long known as the Land of Babel.
Okay, so because it got that, that second effort, kind of, you know, put it into the mythological stream again. You know, and not to mention that, you know, even after all that time, there was ruins there still. So that points out that in those 4.5 years, I mean, they did a lot more than just, you know, push a little sand around or something, you know, getting ready to, you know, they must have had a significant amount of stone structure there already, right? For there to be ruins, in 10,000 B.C. And notice the interesting timing of that, right? 10,000 B.C., 12,000 years ago. That would have been when, if Adam and Eve hadn't defaulted and everything had gone forward, you know, it usually takes about 25,000 years for an Adam and Eve to do their thing and get science up to, you know, its full expression and get the races all blended into one race and fully upstepped. And so that's kind of interesting. See that, right? It coincides with that. There's actually when we look at Paleolithic culture, and we notice the transitions between upper, middle, and lower Paleolithic, old Stone Age culture, it's very interesting that these dates that you see in here actually come out in the archaeology. So there's more than just arbitrariness going on here. There's my guess is that you had kind of a little bit of an intellectual awakening time of some sort. They're at about 10,000 BC, and that maybe that's built into the system. Right, if you're thinking normally, Adam and Eve would have finished up, and there would be kind of this priming of the pump for the magisterial son to come and take things forward. Right? And even though that didn't happen, you know, you see this sort of upstep in Paleolithic culture, you know, at that time. And so, yeah, that's one of the little interesting sidelights. About the fact that it's 150,000 years ago, and of course 40,000 years ago, we know that's going to be something that's going to make an impact because that was the biologic apex. So obviously that's going to leave a mark in the Paleolithic, you know, before and after that. But the fact that you've got the 150,000 and 12,000 years ago ones also is kind of interesting. So between Adam and Eve and the Noddites, you can see some reinforcement of what we've discovered empirically in, you know, through archaeology and looking at, you know, stone tool technology and stuff like that. okay, we don't have a lot of time. This is a big section, but we can get into this section a little bit, I think, here.
Section 4, Noddite Centers of Civilization. The dispersion of the Noddites was an immediate result of the internecine conflict over the Tower of Babel. This internal war greatly reduced the numbers of the purer Noddites and was in many ways responsible for their failure to establish a great pre-Adamic civilization. From this time on, Noddite culture declined for over 120,000 years until it was upstepped by Adamic confusion. But even in the times of Adam, the Noddites were still an able people. Many of their mixed descendants were numbered among the garden builders, and several of Van's group captains were Noddites. Some of the most capable minds serving on Adam's staff were of this race.
So we've come full circle. Yeah, we jumped back, but we've filled it all in now. Now we're back up to where we've read before about Van and his group planting the first garden. notice that they span that last little bit is basically just a linear decline, right? It just nothing, you know, that profound happened. Relative to the Noddites, anyway. It was basically just a decline for 120,000 years. And that's that fact is something to keep in mind about why on every world you have dispensations. You have new celestial individuals coming down and instituting a new dispensation, sort of reinvigorating it. We don't just bootstrap ourselves up to light and life. Right? Kind of left to ourselves, there's a tendency for it to just, taper down, and we need a booster shot again. Even on a normal world, we have no rebellion, no defaults, you get the full biologic uplift, all that sort of stuff. Doesn't mean that you don't have a magisterial son and a bestowal son, Trinity teacher sons. You still need those booster shots because it would at best kind of just go stagnant. But the reality is it's not going to just sort of stay stagnant. It's going to decline because those additional dispensations, all that's involved in them, are helping the peoples of the world to stay synchronized with the cosmos. If you're not sort of keeping up with the evolution of the Supreme, you're dying. You're decaying, you're declining. So we need help. Every world needs help to sort of stay in relationship to the vast whole that's evolving forward. The parts need help staying connected to the whole. And you can bring that down to just to your life. Right? You're not naturally, as a part in the cosmos, going to stay synchronized with the whole. You need to take delight in cultivating. Right? You have to see to that reinvigoration, right, of your relationship to the cosmos. You can't say, well, I've got it here, now I can just rest on my laurels for the rest of my life. You need to be constantly reinvigorating that relationship. Otherwise, you're getting left behind. The evolution of the whole is not going to wait for you. And the reason it doesn't wait for you is because you've been given free will. It's in your hands whether or not you stay synchronized to the whole or not. If you don't want to be, well, fine. it's not going to wait for you. It's very important that we all recognize that. There's nothing natural about a world going forward or you going forward. You have to unnaturally use your free will to choose to synchronize and then move with the whole. All right. You can see we're going to have everyone's going to break up into groups. It's not just the religious group that scurried back down to southern Mesopotamia. There, we have other groups that of those who didn't kill themselves off.
Three out of the four great Nadite centers were established immediately following the Babylon conflict. One, the Western or Syrian Nadites. The remnants of the nationalistic or racial memorialists journeyed northward, uniting with the Andonites to found the later Nadite centers to the northwest of Mesopotamia. This was the largest group of the dispersing Nadites, and they contributed much to the later appearing Assyrian stock.
Oh, see, so we're not just getting a little tidbit about the Sumerians, right, but the Assyrians too. And notice that the emphasis on additional blending is on the Andonites there, as opposed to the Sangiks. So they're giving you that little tidbit that the Assyrians had a greater degree of Andonite than some of the others. And, of course, this group we've already read about, right? This is the group out there on the mainland from the neck of the first garden. This is the group that had Serapeutatia and Kano. See, so that adds a little interesting twist on that. All right, who are these? These are the nationalistic or racial memorialists. When you think about what Serapeutatia had in mind in working with Eve, right? It goes back to this desire to, they wanted to see the tower built as a memorial to Nadite history and racial superiority. It's that mentality and that glory genetically that is kind of the foundation of that flavor of Nadites. It's not surprising, see, that Serapeutatia was thinking the way he was. I was thinking, wow, we've got Adam and Eve here. This is a way to reinvigorate. We knew we'd lost the genetics, but we were trying to keep the civilization going anyway. But we blew that. We just about killed ourselves off. But we can go back to the core thing. We can focus on the genetics again, right? And really get that master race thing going again, right? And they're thinking, that's the way we talk about it, since the Second World War. That's an interesting little loop back to what was going on there with what led to the default. So that same energy that blew up 150,000 years ago, see, blew up with the default as well. Yeah. All right. That's why it's such a tiny little tidbit, because they've already talked a lot about that group, right? That's the group that we've read about with Adam and Eve, the Syrian Nadites. All right, what about group number two?
The Eastern or Elamite Nadites. The culture and commerce advocates migrated in large numbers eastward into Elam, and there united with the mixed Sangic tribes. The Elamites of 30 to 40,000 years ago had become largely Sangic in nature, although they continued to maintain a civilization superior to that of the surrounding barbarians.
Okay, so in this case, so the ones that went east across the Tigris over into what's now Iran, western Iran, and the foothills of the mountains there, they mostly blended with the Sangics and kind of became sort of run-of-the-mill genetics for that area, but still definitely had a civilizational difference, right, that they're holding on to.
So the commerce made a big difference.
And just going back there with the plan of 150,000 years ago, think about how much, if they'd actually succeeded in that and had this definitive center for commerce, trade, that would have produced a peace influence on the planet that would have started a lot sooner. And we all know the passage about visionary peace planning, right, in contrast to international trade. So that's between the lines there. That delayed the progress of peace on the planet a long time. What blew up there 150,000 years ago? All right. Anything else there? Let's see. I think you've got Elam there is, that's a historical thing that, that they're explaining, where did Elam come from? Okay, that's the deal there. So you've got the Sumerians, you've got the Assyrians, you've got the Elamites. They're giving you a number of these. Where did these people at the beginnings of our recorded history come from?
After the establishment of the second garden, it was customary to allude to this nearby Noddite settlement as the, quote, land of Nod. And during the long period of relative peace between this Noddite group and the Adamites, the two races were greatly blended, for it became more and more the custom for the sons of God, the Adamites, to intermarry with the daughters of men, the Noddites.
So now, see, it's different. You know, way down the road, now the higher people, instead of being the Noddites, are the Adamites, and the relatively lower are these blended Noddites. You know, so in that sense, a quote-unquote Nephilim, see, would be the Adamites. Not to mention, you go further on, and, you know, some notion of, like, Nephilim or something akin to that would be the Andites. It's always relative. There, you know, if there's a genetically superior people, right, and they're remembered as sort of giants, and if not having come down from heaven or something, right, as the quote unquote sons of God. All right, and of course, there's, you know, we all know. So that's where Cain went. He went over to those Eastern Noddites. What he did there, you know, as they tell you throughout the book, has a huge impact. That feeds forward from Cain and the fact that, only Eve is his parent. There's that focus on his mom that leads to the Mother of God cult, right? That goes all the way up into, historical times, and, eventually leads to the Virgin Mary concept in the Catholic Church, right? It all goes back to the Eastern Noddites, those ones that went that direction after the war.
What happened to Cano? I forgot.
Cano and Serpentation. Cano was killed. Serpentation drowned himself. Remember, immediately when the garden dwellers found out what happened, they streamed out and killed all of the Noddites in that settlement right there by the peninsula neck. But you can tell from the Western Syrian Noddites, it wasn't just that little group, like we talked about, that was right there by the neck of the peninsula. There was in that whole region, there was a whole bunch of Noddites. They were the big group. So Cana was right local there, but Serapeutica was more, further to the east and, closer to the Euphrates and the headquarters of those Western Noddites. like we talked about, it's sure, he threw himself in the Euphrates Sea and drowned himself. Okay, all right. So we got this little reinforcement, just like we got the reinforcement of the Tower of Babel, so it ends up in the Bible. You've got this reinforcement of the sons of God, daughters of men thing. In more recent times, it gets that into the Bible. So in so many ways, the Adamites reset the mythology that was coming forward from Dalmatia. And that's, they were so similar in so many ways, coming down from heaven, quote unquote. It's no wonder you lost the previous stuff. It was so similar, everyone, lost the distinction and just blurred together. Let's see here. Let's just do the... We'll do number three here, and then we'll wrap it up.
Three, the central or pre-Sumerian Noddites, a small group at the mouth of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, maintained more of their racial integrity. They persisted for thousands of years and eventually furnished the Noddite ancestry, which blended with the Adamites to found the Sumerian peoples of historic times.
Okay, we've already unpacked that, so there it is, just stated directly.
And all this explains how the Sumerians appeared so suddenly and mysteriously on the stage of action in Mesopotamia. Investigators will never be able to trace out and follow these tribes back to the beginning of the Sumerians, who had their origin 200,000 years ago after the submergence of Dalmatia. Without a trace of origin elsewhere in the world, these ancient tribes suddenly loom upon the horizon of civilization with a full-grown and superior culture, embracing temples, metalwork, agriculture, animals, pottery, weaving, commercial law, civil codes, religious ceremonial, and an old system of writing. At the beginning of the historical era, they had long since lost the alphabet of Dalmatia, having adopted the peculiar writing system originating in Dilmun. The Sumerian language, though virtually lost to the world, was not Semitic. It had much in common with the so-called Aryan tongues,
or what we call now Indo-European, right? You know, so that's a delightful little tidbit, see, for the linguists, you know, to appreciate that that's going to, you know, to look again at that language, you know, as being in that same root language space as the roots of the other Indo-European languages, you know, be it Latin or Sanskrit or whatever, right? So that's a fun little tidbit. The peculiar writing system, right? The old system of writing, as they say. What's that? Does anyone know?
Cuneiform.
Yeah. Yep, that's cuneiform. You know, where they, the wedge form, you know, where they have a little wedge tool that they make the impressions in the clay. And I'm sure everyone has seen that. You might not have known it was called cuneiform, but, you know, that's what it is. That's what they're talking about. And to know, you know, and everyone has always wondered, where in the heck did that come from? You know, it seems so different from anything else, you know, from Chinese characters or what have you. Again, it's this little pocket of people that are kind of culturally separate. It actually started in Dilmun. And like they were saying in the first part of that paragraph, see, you know, these people didn't originate somewhere else and migrate so that you could follow that, right? They've just been sitting there for 500,000 years in that same spot. And so eventually when... you know, you have the beginning of recorded history, and you sort of turn on the lights and start recording the state of the world, they just seem to come out of nowhere with all of this, like they're saying, all of this advanced trappings of civilization, right? And everyone has always been mystified by this, you know, and, you know, think about how problematic that is, you know, if you don't just ignore it like they usually do, for rationalizing your out-of-Africa theories, right, say. And it obviously is going to be very problematic to try to somehow figure out, you know, how that whole out-of-Africa thing leads to the Sumerians. You know, so, and especially when you're talking about the Nadites, they came out of the very place, you know, that they are. They came out of southern Mesopotamia. They've always been there, right? You know, they didn't, you know, in many ways, they didn't come from further east like the Sangiks or the Andonites. Right? That eighth race just started there and ended there. Right? Once the other Nadites were totally, you know, blended away, and just sort of residual shades of kind of Sumerian-like architecture and stuff, you know, in a few places, like, you know, over there by where the first garden, you know, used to be. You know, we can see signs of a kind of a little focus of a little bit more. You know, megalithic, you might even say, not in the ancient sense, but a little, you know, big structure sort of stuff rather than just, you know, trivial little sorts of buildings and things. But nothing like the Sumerians. And, you know, so once all those other ones that kind of just blended in, you know, and you had the Assyrians and stuff like that, yeah, the Sumerians, you know, stand apart. And so now historians can know why, right? They're so mysterious. You know, there was a day when we studied more of our, you know, the history of civilization. That was always where it always started, this giant question mark. Where on earth did the Sumerians come from? What is the deal with the Sumerians? You know, every scholar asked that all the time. You know, now we've got, you know, all these goofy rationalization schemes, right? And most kids go all the way through high school and have never even heard of Sumerians, right?
Vice president from any.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, and they can't even point to the United States on a globe, right? But
you know. So this next paragraph touches on mm-hmm. what I'm about to ask. But mm-hmm. so don't they kind of imply we're talking about recorded history as 8,000 BC? In principle, we could find something from much much earlier, a written something or other somewhere.
Oh, sure. Yeah, like they said, if we know where to dig. You know, down in the shallow northern part of the Persian Gulf, we could find one of those little stones with the seven commandments carved on it. You know, that would be coolie.
Date that and blow
it. Right. But, you know, and we are, you know, we are starting to dig up a little bit. You know, everyone knows that in the Near East area there, we're finding some other mysterious old things that everyone's trying to rationalize now. You know, but no one recognizes that, you know, that actually you had very significant stuff going back tens and tens and tens of thousands of years because of the Nodites. Okay. You know, remember when they talked about how, you know, you had metal working? You know, we think the Iron Age is a very recent thing, you know? I mean, they were doing iron way back in time, you know, and we totally forgot that and had to rediscover it. And you can even see that when you go to South America, you know, and you look at some of that megalithic stuff that those Andites led to, and you can see that they had, you know, very sophisticated metalworking and, you know, and building technologies and stuff, right, that, you know, mystify even people today. All right. Okay, so let's get this, yeah, a little bit more here.
The elaborate records left by the Sumerians describe the site of a remarkable settlement, which was located on the Persian Gulf near the earlier city of Dilmun. The Egyptians called this city of ancient glory Dilmut, while the later atomized Sumerians confused both the first and second Nodite cities with Dalmatia and called all three Dilmun. And already have archaeologists found these ancient Sumerian clay tablets, which tell of this earthly paradise where the gods first blessed mankind with the example of civilized and cultured life. And these tablets, descriptive of Dilmun, the paradise of men and God, are now silently resting on the dusty shelves of many museums.
Yep. And, you know, there's, you know, lots of museums. You go in the basement and there's buckets of cuneiform tablets that no one has ever even looked at yet, right? Because back in the day they'd go to, you know, they'd go to Iraq or whatever, you know, and just... You know, literally fill buckets and buckets full of all these things. Now, I mean, a lot of them are just, you know, love letters or, you know, commercial documents or something, you know. But you know, sometimes there's stuff like they're telling you here, you know. And you know, and we now understand that it isn't just made up stuff when they say things like, where the gods first blessed mankind with the example of civilized and cultured life. Right? It's been twice, 500,000 years ago and 40,000 years ago, you know, roughly, that you know, that above came down to those of us below here, as it were. Okay. Anything else there? Oh, yeah, just, you know, see, like I was saying, you've got that whole Dillman thing, and it, they're just pointing out that when we look in our records, there's just a whole bunch of different things all muddled together, see, with that Dillman history. You know, so they're helping us to try to sort that out a little bit. Again, right, we can't figure out stuff like they've told you there. That's why the Revelator can put it in that paragraph. All the other stuff, right, we can figure out ourselves. Yeah, just always remember that, you know, the little tidbits that they're giving you here are they're only allowed to say these things because these are the things that we can't figure out ourselves. And it's up to you to, if you're interested in this stuff, to, you know, to figure out what we've already figured out ourselves and figure out more yourself, fill in the rest of the blanks. Relevators can't give you all the details. All right, a little bit more here.
The Sumerians well knew of the first and second Edens, but despite the extensive intermarriage with the Adamites, continued to regard the garden dwellers to the north as an alien race. Sumerian pride in the more ancient Luddite culture led them to ignore these later vistas of glory in favor of the grandeur and paradisiacal traditions of the city of Dilmun.
Yep, see, so there's, I told you the word pride was in play. As we could see, that it's pride went before the fall of the tower. You know, it goes before all the falls.
This is in contrast to even when technically the Adamites are now the quote unquote sons of God and the Nodites are the daughters of men. Right, that's not how they see it. No, we're the quote unquote sons of God, and we always will be, that pride thing. But the funny thing about that, just, you know, these pre-Sumerian Nodites, like I was saying, if you wait long enough, everyone else blends and lowers down, and you end up kind of being a little cut above the rest again, right? I mean, you know, you go through all the machinations there in Mesopotamia, and eventually you've got, you know, the Babylonian Empire there, and you still have the wise people down there in the south. Yeah. So if you wait enough millennia, you know, you find yourself kind of back on top again. So, you try to civilize these barbarian raiders that, you know, came from the north. All right, so we'll do that fourth little item next time, then we'll get that last little tidbit. Which serves as a preface for shifting gears now, kind of setting the Nodites aside and getting back to the story of what happened in the wake of the fault in the second garden. How do we get the secondary midwares? Remember, that's the, yeah, we're supposedly reading a paper about the midway creatures, right? So we can get back to that story next time here. All right, let's take a moment, everyone.